From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Up Under the Roof by Manly Wade Wellman. When I was 12 years old, I lived in a shabby old two-story house, built square below and double-gabled above. The four gables contained an upstairs room apiece, each facing a different direction, and the entire four making a cross with a hall and stairwell at the center. The front and side rooms were sealed and plastered and calcined for bedrooms, but the unfinished rear one held only trunks, boxes, and broken furniture. This part of the house was hot and dusty and open right up to the peak of its gable. Directly above its doorway to the central hall gaped an empty dark triangle leading into the slant-sided cave above the bedroom ceilings. This lumber room was called the garret, though it was not a real garret. The real garret was that dark space up under the roof. I was the youngest person in the house by more than a decade, and my youth offended everyone bitterly. I was constantly reminded of my childish stupidity and inexperience. Nobody felt that years would mend me, and in time, I grew to share that opinion. I tried never to make a statement or venture an opinion that had not been voiced previously by one of my elders. Even at that, I came in for plenty of snubs and corrections and learned to withdraw into myself. The downstairs parlor was full of books, and I read in them a great deal, including nearly all of an old Encyclopedia Britannica. This taste for reading attracted some curious attention on the part of my guardians. Occasionally, one of them would suggest to the other that I might be trained for the law or the ministry. Never was I consulted as to my own ambition, which would have shocked the household. I wanted to be a deep-sea diver. The summer was a hot one, and my room in the gable on the right, or northern side, had only one window. The sun's rays fell directly on the sloping wall, which were the only gable's pitches plastered in, affording little insulation. I slept poorly, bothered by strange and vivid dreams. Sometimes I started awake, itching nervously at armpits and groins, hearing every rustle of the cottonwoods outside and the creakings of the house timbers. After a while, I'm not sure exactly when I began to hear something else. Awareness of that sound grew upon me, first slowly and faintly, then with terrifying clarity over a number of hot, wakeful nights. It was something up above, between the roof peak and the ceiling, something big and clumsy and stealthy. I remember telling myself once that it was a rat, but the moment the thought came into my head, I knew it for a silly lie. Rats skip and scamper, they are light and sure. This was huge and weighty, of a bulk that I judge was far more than my own, and it moved, I say, with a slow, unsure stealth that had sustained rhythm of a sort. It did not drag or walk, but it moved. Years afterward, I saw through a microscope the plodding of an amoeba. The thing up under the roof sounded as an amoeba looks, a mass stretching out a thin, loose portion of itself, then rolling and flowing all of its substance into that portion, and so creeping along, only it must have been many, many thousands of times larger than an amoeba. Before long, I was hearing the noise every night. I would wait for it, lying awake until it humped itself across the ceiling above me. Always with it came fear, fear that did not diminish with time. I would stare in the dark, my tongue would dry up between my teeth, and my fingertips would tingle as though they had been rubbed sore. On my back would sprout and fan and winnow little involuntary wings of chill, making my spine shrink and quiver as though ice mingled with the marrow. The ceiling, I knew, would descend some night upon me, like a great millstone, then crumble about my bed. Something huge and soft would wiggle free of the broken bits and sprawl upon me. There could be no talking about the business, I well knew. Long before, I had learned that nobody would listen or care. As I have said, I was resented by the other dwellers in that house. Once, when a neighbor boy of 15 gave me a terrible beating in the front yard, everyone watched from our front windows, but none stirred to help me, not even when I thought I would fall dead at my enemy's scornful feet. When tired of pulping my face with his knuckles, he turned away at last. I dragged myself in and was tongue-lashed on all sides for an hour. Today I cannot remember exactly what was urged against me, but the tears I had not shed for pain welled forth under the scolding. Things like that made me hesitate about asking for help. One morning I did inquire at breakfast if the others had heard anything strange, but I was only reprimanded for interrupting a discussion of local politics. That night the noise was louder and more terrifying than ever. It began above some other room, and then it trundled along my ceiling, slower and still slower until it paused just over my bed. It seemed to me at that moment that the lath and plaster were no tighter or stronger than a spider web, and that the entity was incalculably more awful than the prince and father of all spiders. It crouched there, almost within reach of me, gloating and hungering, turning over in its dark mind the problems of when and how to take hold of me. I could not have stirred from my bed, could not have cried out even. The thing and its fear were with me always, night after night and week after week, until a day past the middle of the summer, a dark and rainy day when it did not wait for nightfall. I was alone in the house, tired of hearing the rain and the swish of wet leaves outside. I had exhausted the books in the parlor and remembered a stack of illustrated magazines, very old, in the lumber room. I climbed the stairs. The lumber room was unthinkably ugly and close, with a sort of brown light reflected by the unpainted joists and the insides of the shingles. I found the magazines and began to paw through them. All had been silent except for the rain outside, but in the midst of my searching there came a hump, hump from above, from the opening that led above the ceiling. Something sly and heavy was there looking down upon me. But in one scrambling moment, I had fled downstairs and to the front door. It was no swelling of courage that made me pause before rushing out, only a sensible, if hopeless, consideration of what must follow. I could leave the house and mope in the rainy street until someone came back. Then I would have to come back too, and in time I would have to go to bed. Then the creature that made the noise would come down. It would wait no longer, for it had seen me and my tortured terror. It would flow to the floor, through my door, and creep into bed with me. I would know how it looked, what color it was, and what it wanted with me. A cold determination came, I knew not whence, stiffening my limbs and neck like new sawdust poured into an empty doll. I walked slowly back through the house to the foot of the stairs. There I paused, trying to lift myself to the bottom step. I could not, and turned and walked to the back porch. There upon the wood box lay a hand axe. It was dull and rusty and wobbled upon its helf, but I took it, and this time I mounted the steps, slowly, one after another, and with long, tight breaths between. The old boards creaked under my feet as if aghast at my foolish daring. I reached the upper hall and went back into the lumber room. It had turned darker than when I had first come to find the magazines. I made myself look up at the triangular opening, and that took a mustering of all my willpower. But there was nothing to see. I stuck the handle of the axe into the waistband of my knickerbockers and dragged a heavy, dust-laden old bureau over against the wall by the door. On that I placed a broken chair, then a candle box precariously on end. At last I climbed up on the bureau, up on the chair, up on the box. My chin came level with the threshold of the black cavern. It was like I was gazing into a pool of ink. I got hold of a cross timber and drew myself slowly up. The candle box tipped over and fell from beneath my feet, striking the floor of the lumber room with a crash like an explosion. but the next moment I had dragged myself up inside the loft. The roof peak was so low above my head that I could barely rise to my knees. I pulled out the axe and tried to hold it in my mouth like a pirate's dirk, but it was too big and heavy, so I kept it in my right hand. Then on my knees and on my left hand, I went forward on top of the rafters. Every inch took me deeper into darkness, and when I reached and crept past a big rough chimney, I might as well have been in a coal mine. First, I went straight to the front of the house. I felt all along the wall and into the corners. Then I dragged myself around. I could see the light at the far end, partly obstructed by the chimney. Crawling back, I explored gropingly the space above the south bedroom. Last of all, I drove myself into the chamber above my own room, where I had always heard the sound. I found nothing. I always finished with those three words. When grown up enough to be listened to, I told this story in after years. But I knew then, and I know now, that there was something, or that there had been something, until I drove myself to face it. That something had been a mortal peril. Had I done anything else, it would have come looking for me. What would have followed, I'm not sure. Nobody can think. But from that time forward, there was not the slightest murmur of noise up under the roof. I grew to sleep so soundly that I had to be shaken in the mornings. Nor did I ever know fear again. Not even in the war. The Valley Was Still by Manly Wade Wellman. Wind touched the pines on the ridge and stirred the thicker forest on the hills opposite, but the grassy valley between, with its red and white houses at the bottom, was as still as a painted backdrop in a theater. Not even a grasshopper sang in it. Two cavalrymen sat their mounts at the edge of the pines. The one in the torn butternut blouse hawked and spat, and the sound was strangely loud at the brink of that silence. "I'd reckon the Yanks was down in that there little town," he said. "Chanow, it's called. Joe, you look like a Yank yourself in them clothes." His mate, who wore half-weathered blue, did not appear complimented. The garments have been stripped from an outraged sergeant of Pennsylvania Lancers, taken prisoner at the 7 Days. They fitted their new wearer's lean body nicely, except across the shoulders. His boots were likewise trophies of war, from the 2nd Manassas, where the Union Army had learned that lightning can strike twice in the same place, and his saddlecloth, with its U.S. stamp, had also been unwillingly furnished by the Federal Army. But the gray horse had come from his father's Virginia farm and had lived through a year of fierce fighting and fiercer toil. The rider's name was Joseph Paradine, and he had recently declined with thanks the offer of General J.E.B. Stuart, who recommended him for a commission. He preferred to serve as a common trooper. He was a chivalric idealist and a peerless scout. "You'd better steal some Yankee blues yourself, Dogger," he advised. "Those homespun pants would drop off of you if you stood up in your stirrups. Yes, the enemy's expected to take up a position in Chanow Valley, but if he had done so, we'd have run into his vedettes by now, and that town would be as noisy as a county fair." He rode from among the pines and into the open on the lower slope. "You're plumb exposing yourself, Joe," warned Dogger anxiously. "And I'm going to expose myself more," returned Paradine, his eyes in the valley. "We've been told to find the Yankees and establish their whereabouts. Then our people will tackle them." He spoke of the confidence of triumph that in the summer of 1862 possessed Confederates who had driven the Union's bravest and best all through Virginia. "I'm going all the way down." "There'll be Yanks hiding," suggested Dogger pessimistically. "They'll plug you plumb full of lead." "If they do," called Paradine, "ride back and tell the boys, because then you'll know the Yankees actually are in Chanow." He put his horse to the slope, feeling actually happy at the thought that he might suffer for the sake of his cause. It is worthy of repetition that he was a chivalric idealist. Dogger, quite as brave but more practical, bode where he was. Paradine, riding downhill, passed out of reach of any more warnings. Paradine's eyes were kept on the village as he descended deep into silence as into water. He had never known such silence, not even at the frequent prayings of his own devout regiment. It made him nervous, a different nervousness from the tingling elation brought by battle thunders, and it fairly daunted a seasoned and intelligent horse. The beast tossed its head, sniffed, danced precariously, and had to be urged to the slope's foot and the trail that ran there. From the bottom of the slope, the village was a scant 2 miles away. Its chimneys did not smoke, nor did its trees stir in the windless air, nor was there sign or motion upon its streets and among its houses of red brick and white wood. No enemy soldiers or anything else. Was this a trap? But Paradine smiled at the thought of a whole Yankee brigade or more lying low to capture one lone Southerner. More likely they thought him a friend, wearing blue as he did. But why silence in that case either? He determined to make noise. If there were hostile forces in and among the houses of Chanao, he would draw their attention, perhaps their musket fire. Sparingly, the gray, so that it wickered and plunged, he forced it to canter at an angle toward the nearest houses. At the same time, he drew his saber, whetted to a razor's edge contrary to regulations, and waved it over his head. He gave the rebel yell high and fierce. Paradine's voice was a strong one, and it could ring from end to end of a brigade line, but even as he yelled, that yell perished, dropped from his lips as though cut away. He could not have been heard 10 yards. Had his throat dried up? Then suddenly he knew. There was no echo here, for all the ridge lay behind and the hills in front to the north. Even the galloping hoofs of the gray sounded muffled, as if in cotton. Strange, there was no response to his defiance. That was more surprising still. If there were no enemy troops, what about the people of the town? Paradine felt his brown neck hair, which needed cutting badly, rise and stiffen. Something sinister lay yonder and warned him away. But he had ridden into this valley to gather intelligence for his officers. He could not turn back and respect himself thereafter as a gentleman and a soldier. Has it been noted that Paradine was a chivalric idealist? But his horse, whatever its blood and character, lacked such selfless devotion to the cause of states' rights. It faltered in its gallop, tried first to turn back and then to throw Paradine. He cursed it feelingly, fought it with bit, knee, and spur, and finally pulled up and dismounted. He drew the reins forward over the tossing gray head, thrust his left arm through the loop, and with his left hand drew the big cap-and-ball revolver from his bolster. Thus ready, with shot or saber, he proceeded on foot, and the gray followed him protestingly. "Come on," he scolded very loudly. He was sick of the silence. "I don't know what I'm getting into here. If I have to retreat, it won't be on foot." Half a mile more at a brisk walk, a quarter mile beyond that more slowly, for still there was no sound or movement from the village. Then the trail joined the wagon track, and Paradine came to the foot of the single street of Chanao. He looked along it and came to an abrupt halt. The street, with its shaded yards on either side, was littered with slack blue lumps, each the size of a human body. The Yankee army, or its advance guard, was there, but fallen and stony still. "Dead," muttered Paradine under his breath. But who could have killed them? Not his comrades, who had not known where the enemy was. Plague, then? But the most withering plague takes hours at least, and these had plainly fallen all in the same instant. Paradine studied the scene. Here had been a proper entry of a strange settlement. First a patrol, watchful and suspicious, then a larger advance party in two single files, each file hugging one side of the street with eyes and weapons commanding the other side, and finally the main body, men, horses, and guns with a baggage train. All as it should be, but now prone and still like tin soldiers strewn on a floor after a game. The house at the foot of the street had a hitching post, cast from iron to represent a boy with a ring in one lifted hand. To that thing, Paradine tethered the now almost unmanageable gray. He heard a throbbing roll as of drums, which he identified as the blood beating in his ears. The saber hilt was slippery with the sweat of his palm. He knew that he was afraid and did not relish the knowledge. Stubbornly, he turned his boot toes forward and approached the fallen ranks of the enemy. The drums in his ears beat a cadence for his lone march. He reached and stood over the nearest of the bodies. A blue-bloused infantryman, this, melted over on his face, his hands slack upon the musket lying crosswise beneath him. The peak forage cap had fallen from rumpled bright hair. The check, what Paradine could see of it, was as downy as a peach. Only a kid. Young to die. But was he dead? There was no sign of a wound. Too, a certain waxy finality was lacking in that slumped posture. Paradine extended the point of his saber and gingerly prodded a sudden reddened wrist. No response. Paradine increased the pressure. A red drop appeared under the point and grew. Paradine scowled. The boy could bleed. He must be alive, after all. "Wake up, Yankee," said Joseph Paradine, and stirred the blue flank with his foot. The flesh yielded, but did not stir otherwise. He turned the body over. A vacant pink face stared up out of eyes that were fixed but bright. Not death, and not sleep. Paradine had seen men in a swoon who looked like that, yet even swooners breathed, and there was not a hair's line of motion under the dim brass buttons. Funny, thought Paradine, not meaning that he was amused. He walked on, because there was nothing left to do. Just beyond that first fallen lad lay the rest of the patrol, still in the diamond-shaped formation they must have held when awake and erect. One man lay at the right side of the street, another opposite him at the left. The corporal was in the center, and to his rear another private. The corporal was, or had been, an excitable man. His hand clutched his musket firmly. His lips drew back from gritted teeth. His eyes were narrow instead of staring. A bit of awareness seemed to remain upon the set, stubbly face. Paradine forbore to prod him with a saber, but stooped and twitched up an eyelid. It snapped back to its squint. The corporal, too, lived, but did not move. "Wake up," Paradine urged him, as he urged the boy. "You aren't dead." He straightened up and stared at the more distant and numerous blue bodies in their fallen ranks. "None of you are dead," he protested at the top of his lungs, unable to beat down his hysteria. "Wake up, Yankees!" He was pleading with them to rise, even though he would be doomed if they did. "You're all my prisoners," he yelled. "Up on your feet!" "You're wasting your breath, son." Paradine whirled like a top to face his sudden, quiet rebuke. A man stood in the front yard of a shabby house opposite, leaning on a picket fence. Paradine's first impression was of noble and vigorous old age, for a mighty cascade of white beard covered the speaker's chest, and his brow was fringed with thick, cottony hair. But next moment, Paradine saw that the brow was strangely narrow and sunken, that the mouth in the midst of its hoary ambush hung wryly slack, and that the eyes were bright, but empty like cheap imitation jewels. The stranger moved slowly along the fence until he came to a gate. He pushed it quickly open and moved across the dusty road toward Paradine. His body and legs were meager, even for an old man, and he shook and shuffled as though extremely feeble. His clothing was a hodgepodge of filthy tatters. At any rate, he was no soldier foe. Paradine holstered his revolver and leaned on his saber. The bearded one came close, making a slow circuit of two fallen soldiers that lay in his path. Close at hand, he appeared as tall and gaunt as a flagstaff, and his beard was a fluttering white flag, but not for truce. "I spoke to him," he said quietly, but definitely, and they dozed off like they was drunk.
"You mean these troops?"
"Well, son, they come marching from them hills to the north. The folks scattered out of here like rabbits, all but me. I waited, and I put these here Yanks to sleep." He reached under his veil of beard, apparently fumbling in the bosom of his ruined shirt. His brown old fork of a hand produced a dingy book bound in gray paper. "This does it," he said. Paradine looked at the front cover. It bore the woodcut of an owl against a round moon. The title was in black capitals: "John George Hammond's Powwows or Long Lost Friend. Got a long time back from a Pennsylvania witch man." Paradine did not understand and was not sure that he wanted to. He still wondered how so many fighting men could lie stunned. "I thought you was a Yank and I'd miss you somehow," the quiet old voice informed him. "That's a Yank soldier suit, ain't it?"
I was going to read ye some sleep words, but you give the yellin, I knew you was such. Paradine made a gesture as though to brush away a troublesome fly. He must investigate further. Up the street he walked among the prone soldiers. It took him half an hour to complete his survey, walking from end to end of that unconscious host. He saw infantry men and officers sprawling together in slack comradeship, three batteries of parrot guns still coupled to their limbers, with horses slumped in their harness, and riders and drivers fallen in the dust beneath the wheels. A body of cavalry. It should have been scouting out front, thought Paradine professionally, all down and still, like a whole park full of equestrian statues overturned. Wagons and finally last of the procession, save for a prudently placed rear guard, a little clutter of men in gold braid. He approached the oldest and stoutest of these, noting the two stars on his shoulder straps. A major general. Paradine knelt, unbuttoned the frock coat, and felt in the pockets. Here were papers. The first he unfolded was the copy of an order. General T. F. Cutler, commanding Division USA. General, you will be moving immediately with your entire force, taking up a strong defensive position in the Chanao Valley. This, then, was Cutler's division. Paradine estimated the force is 5,000 bluecoats, all veterans by the look of them, but nothing that his own comrades would have feared. He studied the wagon train hungrily. It was packed with food and clothing, badly needed by the Confederacy. He would do well to get back and report his find. He turned and saw that the old man with a white beard had followed him through the street. "I reckon," he said to Paradine in tones of mild reproach, "you think I'm a lyin' about putting these here Yanks to sleep." Paradine smiled at him, as he might have smiled at an importunate child. "I didn't call you a liar," he temporized. "And the Yankees are certainly in dreamland. But I think there must be some natural explanation for." "Happen I can show you better and tell you," cut in the dotard. His paper-bound book was open in his scrawny hands. Stooping close to it, he began rapidly to mumble something. His voice suddenly rose, sounded almost young. "Now, stand here till I tell you to move." Paradine, standing, fought for explanations. What was happening to him could be believed, was even logical. Mesmerism, scholars called it, or a newer name, hypnotism. As a boy, he, Paradine, had amused himself by holding a hen's beak to the floor and drawing a chalk line therefrom. The hen could never move until he lifted it away from that mock tether. That was now befell him, he was sure. His muscles were slack, or perhaps tense. He could not say by the feel. In any case, they were immovable. He could not move eyes. He could not loosen grip on his saber hilt. Yes, hypnotism. If only he rationalized it, he could break the spell. But he remained motionless, as though he were the little iron figure to which his horse was tethered, yonder at the foot of the street. The old man surveyed him with a flick of shrewdness in those bright eyes that had seemed foolish. "I used only half power. Happen you can still hear me, so listen. My name's Teague. I live down yon by the crick. I'm a witch man, and my pappy was a witch man afore me. He was the seventh son of a seventh son, and I was his seventh son. I know conjure stuff, black and white, forward and backwards, it's my livin'. Folks in Chanao make fun of me like they did o' my pappy when he was livin', but they buy my charms, things to bring love or hate, if they hanker for 'em. Cures for sick hogs and calves, saints to drive away fever, all them things. I done it for Chanao folks all my life." It was a proud pronouncement, Paradine realized. Here was the man diligent in business, who could stand before kings. So might speak a statesman who had long served his constituency, or the editor of a paper that had built respectful traditions, or a doctor who had guarded a town's health for decades, or a blacksmith who took pride in his lifetime of skilled toil. This gaffer, who called himself a witch man, considered that he had done service and was entitled to respect and gratitude. The narrator went on more grimly. "Sometimes I've been laughed at and told to mind my own business. Young'uns has hootin', throwed stones. I could have cursed them, but I didn't. No, sir. They's my friends and neighbors, Chanao folks. I kept back evil from 'em. old figure straightened, the white beard jutted forward, an exultant note crept in. "But when the Yanks come and everybody run for 'em but me, I didn't have no scruples. Invaders, tyrants, thieving skunks in blue." Teague sounded like a recruiting officer for Texas Regiment. "I didn't know them nothing, and here in the street I faced them. I dug out this here little book, and I read the sleep words to them. See?" And the old hands gestured sweepingly. "They sleep till I tell them to wake. If I ever tell them." Paradine had to believe this tale of occult patriotism. There was nothing else to believe in its place. The old man, who called himself Teague, smiled tweakingly. "You fight the Yanks. If you'll be good and not give me no arguments, blink your left eye." Power blinking returned to that lid, and Paradine lowered it submissively. "Now you can move again. I'll say the words." He leafed through the book once more and read out, "Your horsemen and footmen conjured here at this time. You may pass on in the name of..." Paradine did not catch the name, but heard a sound that chilled him. Next instant, motion was restored to his arms and legs. The blood tickled sharply in them, as if they had been asleep. Teague offered him a hand, and Paradine took it. That hand was froggy cold and soft for all its boniness. "Out of this," decreed Teague. "Do what I tell you, or I'll read you something you'll like less." And he held out the open book significantly. Paradine saw the page. It bore the number 60 in one corner, and at its top was a heading in capital: "To release spellbound persons." Beneath were the lines with which Teague had set him in motion again, and among them were smudged inky marks. "You've crossed out some words," Paradine said at once. "Yep. I wrote in others." Teague held the book closer to him. Paradine felt yet another chill and beat down a desire to turn away. He spoke again because he felt that he should. "It's the name of God that you've cut out, Teague. Not once, but three times. Isn't that blasphemy? And you've written in the name of somebody else." Teague's beard ruffled into a grin. "Young fellow, you don't understand. This book was wrote full of the name of God. That name is good for some things. But for curses and deaths and overthrows such as this one, well, I changed the name and spells by putting in that other name you saw, and it works fine." He grinned wider as he surveyed the tumbled thousands around him, then shut the book and put it away. Paradine had been well educated. He had read Marlowe's Dr. Faustus at the University of Virginia and some accounts of the New England witchcraft cases. He could grasp, though he had never been called upon, to consider the idea of an alliance with evil. All he could reply was, "I don't see more than 5,000 Yankees in this town. Our boys can whip that many and more without any spells." Teague shook his head. "Come on, let's go and sit on them steps," he invited, pointing. The two walked back down the street, into the yard, and dropped down upon a porch. The shady leaves above them hung as silent as chips of stone. Through the fence picket showed the blue lumps of quiet that had been a fighting division of Federals. There was no voice except Teague's. "You don't grasp what war means, young feller. Sure, the South's winning now, but to win, men must die. Powder must burn, and the South ain't got men and powder enough to keep it up." If Paradine had never thought of that before, neither had his superiors, except possibly General Lee. Yet it was plainly true. Teague extended the argument. "But if every Yank army was put to sleep, fast as got in reach, what then? How'd you like to lead your own enemy into Washington and grab old Abe Lincoln right out of the White House? How'd you like to be the second greatest man of the South?" "Second greatest man?" echoed Paradine breathlessly, forgetting to fear. He was being tempted as few chivalric idealists can endure. "Second only to Robert E. Lee." The name of his general trembled on his lips. It trembles to this day on the lips of those who remember, but Teague only snickered and combed his beard with fingers like skinny sticks. "You don't catch on yet. Second man, not to Lee, but to me, Teague, for I'd be a-running things." Paradine, who had seen and heard so much Tomasum during the past hour, had yet the capacity to gasp. His saber was between his knees, and his hands tightened on the hilt, until the knuckles turned pale. Teague gave no sign. He went on, "I ain't never got no respect here in Chanel. Happen it's time I showed him what I can do, as I studied the windows of men he had caused to drop down like sickled wheat. Creases of proud triumph deepened around his eyes. We'll do all the Yanks this way, son. Your generals ain't ever done anything like it, have they? His generals? Paradine had seen them on occasion. Jackson, named Stonewall for invincibility, kneeling in unashamed public prayer. Jeb Stuart, with his plume and his brown beard, listening to the clang of Sweeney's banjo. Hood, who outcharged even his wild Texans. Polk, blessing the soldiers in the dawn before battle, like a prophet of brave old days. And Lee, the gray knight at whom Teague had laughed. No, they had never done anything like it, and if they could, they would not. Teague, said Paradine, this isn't right.
Not right? Oh, I know what you mean.
You don't like them names I wrote into the powwows, do you? But ain't everything fair in love and war?
Teague laid a persuasive claw on the sleeve of Paradine's looted jacket.
Listen to Sunset. Your idea is to win with sword and gun. Mine's to win by conjuring. Which is the quickest way?
The easiest way? The only way?
To my own ways of thinking, the only way is by fair fight. God, pronounced Paradine as stiffly as Leonidas Polk himself, watches armies.
And so does somebody else, responded Teague. Watches and listens.
Happen he's listening this minute. Well, lad, I need a soldier to figure army things for me. You joining me?
Not only Teague's waiting for Paradine's answer, the young trooper remembered from Pilgrim's Progress what sort of dealings might be fatal. Slowly he got to his feet.
The South doesn't need that kind of help, he said flatly.
Too late to back out, Teague told him.
What do you mean?
The help's been asked for already, son, and it's been given. A contract, you might call it.
If the contract's broke, well, happen the other party'll get mad. They can be worse enemies than Yanks.
Teague, too, rose to his feet.
Too late, he said again. That power can sweep armies away for us. But if we say no, well, it's been roused up. It still sweeps away armies, southern armies.
You think I shouldn't have started such a thing? But I've started it. Can't turn back now.
Victory through evil. What would it become in the end? False story told, and so did the legend of Gilles de Retz and the march about Macbeth. But there was also the tale of the sorcerer's apprentice and of what befell him when he tried to reject the force he had thoughtlessly evoked.
What do you want me to do? He asked, through lips that muddled the words.
Good lad. I thought you see sense. First off, I want your name to the bargain. Then me and you can lick the Yanks.
Lick the Yanks?
Paradine remembered a gaily profane catchphrase of the Confederate camp. Don't say Yankee, say damn Yankee.
But what about a damn Confederacy?
Teague spoke of the day of victory. What of the day of reckoning?
What payment would this ally ask in the end?
Again Foss popped into his mind. He imagined the Confederacy as a Faust among the nations, devil lifted, devil nurtured, and devil doomed, by the connivance of one Joseph Paradine. Better disaster in the way of man's warfare. The bargain was offered him for all the South. For all the South he must reject, completely and finally.
Aloud he said, My name? Signed to something?
Right here'll do.
Once more Teague brought forth the powwow's book, which he had edited so strangely.
Here, son, on this back page, in blood.
Paradine bowed his head. It was to conceal the look in his eyes, and he hoped to look as though he acquiesced. He drew his saber, passed it to his left hand. Upon its tips he pressed his right forefinger. A spot of dull pain and a drop of blood creeping forth, as had appeared on the wrist of the ensorcelled boy lying yonder among the Yankees in the street.
That'll be enough to sign with, approved Teague.
He flattened out the book, exposing the rear flyleaf. Paradine extended his reddened forefinger. It stained the rough white paper.
J for Joseph, dictated Teague.
Yep, like that.
Paradine galvanized into action. His bloody right hand seized the book, wrenching it from the trembling fingers. With a saber in his left hand, he struck. A pretty stroke for even a practiced swordsman. The honed edge of the steel fell on the shaggy side of Teague's scrawny neck. Paradine felt bone impeding his powerful drawing slash.
Then he felt it no longer. The neck had sliced in two, and for a moment, Teague's head hung free in the air like a lantern on a wire. The bright eyes fixed Paradine's. The mouth fell open in the midst of the beard, trying to speak a word that would not come. Then it fell, bounced like a ball, and rolled away. The headless trunk stood on braced feet, crumpling slowly. Paradine stepped away from it, and it collapsed upon the steps of the house. Again there was utter silence in the town and valley of Chanel. The blue soldiers did not budge where they lay. Paradine knew that he alone moved and breathed and saw. No, not entirely alone. His horse was tethered at the end of the street. He flung away his saber and ran, unashamed no more of his dread. Reaching the gray, he found his fingers shaky, but he wrenched loose the knotted reins. Flinging himself into the saddle, he rode away across the level and up the slope. The pines sighed gently, and that sound gave him comfort after so much soundlessness. He dismounted his knees, swaying as though their tendons had been cut, and studied the earth. Here were the footprints of Dogger's horse. Here also was a cleft stick, and in a folded scrap of paper a note. He lifted it and read the pencil scrawl. "Dear friend Joe, you ain't come back, so I left like you said to bring up the boys. I hope you are right, and if the Yankees have got you, we'll get you back. L. Dogger." His comrades were coming then, with guns and swords. They expected to meet Union soldiers. Paradine gazed back into the silent spring valley, then at what he still held in his right hand. It was the powwow's book, marked with a wet capital J in his own blood. What had Teague insisted? The one whose name had been invoked would be fatally angry if his help was refused, but Paradine was going to refuse it. He turned to page 60. His voice was shaky, but he managed to read aloud. "Your horsemen and footmen conjured here at this time. You may pass on in the name of..." He faltered but disregarded the ink blotting and the substituted names of Jesus Christ and through the Word of God. Again he gulped and finished. "You may now ride on and pass." From under his feet burst a dry, startling thunder of sound, a partridge rising to the sky. Further down the slope, a crow took wing, cawing querulously. Wind awakened in the Chanel Valley. Paradine saw the distant trees of the town stir with it. Then a confused din came to his ears, as though something besides wind was awakening. After a moment he heard the notes of a bugle, shrill and tremulous, sounding in alarm. Paradine struck fire and built it up with fallen twigs. Into the hardest heart of it he thrust Teague's Book of Charms. The flame gnawed eagerly at it, the pages crumpled and fanned and blackened with the heat. For a moment he saw standing out among charred fragments a blood-red jay, his writing, as though it fought for life. Then it too was consumed, and there was only ashes. Before the last red tongue subsided, his ears picked up a faint rebel yell, and afar into the valley rode Confederate cavalry. He put his gray to the gallop, got down the slope, and joined the regiment before it reached the town. On the street a Union line was forming. There was hot, fierce fighting, such as had scattered and routed many a northern force. But at the end of it, the Southerners ran like foxes before hounds, and those who escaped counted themselves lucky. In his later garrulous years, Joseph Paradine was apt to say that the war was lost, not at Antietam or Gettysburg, but at a little valley hamlet called Chanel. Refusal of a certain alliance, he would insist, was the cause that offered ally fought then force against the South. But nobody paid attention except to laugh or to pity. So many veterans go crazy.